Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and this episode was recorded in person at Brooks HQ in Seattle, Washington, with Joe McConaughey shortly after the Barkley Marathons. We recount Jasmine Paris's finish, the historical significance of that moment for our sport, the impact of five finishers this year, what makes Barkley so interesting in our minds, Joe's race recap with training, nutritional, and racing insights for future editions, and we conclude with a few other memorable moments across the three-day stretch. Before we get started, though, thank you so much to NAC for supporting this episode. NAC makes complete nutrition products designed specifically for ultra runners like us. Their Ultra Energy Drink Mix, for example, provides complete proteins and BCAAs at optimized levels to work against muscle fiber breakdown when you're out there in races or on long runs. And in addition to all that, I just find their flavors light and refreshing. It's less sweet than other drink mixes out there. Plus, you get everything you need, again, in terms of calories and macronutrients, all in liquid form. If you're curious and you want to try some yourself, head over to NAAK.com, that's spelled N-A-A-K.com, and use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout for 15% off your first order. With that, let's get on to this episode with Joe McConaughey.
I was just trying to think, except for our Western States pre-show last summer, this is the first time we've ever done a one-on-one live podcast interview on Single Track. We are in...
Wait, this is a live podcast interview?
Not live, sorry. It's not live. It's recorded together. We're in person. Sorry. Oh, terminology. Messed up my terminology. End of the day, running on fumes, in-person pod in a pretty surreal location. This is the Brooks HQ in the Fremont neighborhood of Seattle, Washington, joined by my friend and many-time visitor to the Single Track Podcast, Joe McConaughey. What's up, Joe?
We just fist bumped because you can do that in person.
They actually have like the thing on Riverside where if you like raise your thumb or whatever, like for like a thumbs up or your hand, it does those things too, but yeah.
Oh, it does a little action?
It does like the action thing, like balloons will pop up and all that, yeah. Like the bubble thumbs up will go up. It's crazy. Yeah, we're here because we're a couple days removed from our experience at the Barkley Marathons. We're now embedded in the Brooks Athlete training camp for the trail team, and we just figured that there's probably a lot of people that want to hear sort of a long-form recap of what we experienced and what you experienced as an athlete. I think the first thing we got to cover is Jasmine Paris being the first female finisher of this race ever.
She finished?
She finished.
What do you mean? Only New York Times and BBC is reporting it.
Jasmine Paris is the first female finisher ever of this race. What were your reactions? Like, walk us back through what that moment standing at the gate was for you.
Yeah, that's probably, watching Jasmine finish is probably, for many reasons, one of the best moments in sport I'll ever witness. And there's two reasons for that. One, it's a expectation-defying performance. There are people who, sometimes it's a joke, sometimes it's a serious statement, and sort of wrapped up in some probably not so great ideology, but the fact that a woman can never complete Barkley, that a female can never complete Barkley. And it's been 35 years that this race has been happening. Prior to this year, there had been 17 finishers, and all of those finishers were male. And Jasmine became the first female to finish the Barkley Marathon, which is rad.
I got to tell you my story, which was wild. So internet connection at Barkley is variable. Like there's just many places in camp out at Ratshaw where like you're just not going to get any service. I had found some at the visitor center. And so what I had been doing at the end of the race, because we were kind of there in a media capacity, was Drew Darby, our videographer, photographer, would airdrop me photos of like, you know, Jared Campbell finishing and, you know, Ihor finishing, Greg finishing, et cetera. And in between all those finishers, I would take those airdropped photos and I would sprint the half mile to the visitor center and I would quickly get out like the Instagram update. Like, okay, like, you know, here's who's made it. Here's the update because people were kind of craving that. As I'm walking down, the road from the Big Cove campground to the visitor center to publish the Jared Campbell update. To my right on that last part of the course footpath, I hear some rustling in the trees, kind of, you know, in that whole like wooded area. And at that point, there were like 3 minutes left in the race. Sorry, 5 minutes left in the race. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. There is no way this is happening. Because at that point, the only person left that we were concerned about was Jasmine. Like, was she going to get under the time? Damien had tapped out. Sebastian had tapped out. It was just Jasmine. I hear this like rustling in the woods. I stop, turn to my right, and I see her red jersey. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. So first it was like this amazing excitement because she's made it interesting. And I'm blown away by that. I immediately turn around. I start kind of following her parallel to the course. I'm on the road. She's on that footpath. I see her come out of the footpath. She's finally on pavement. And my heart breaks because, and this was new to me, but that entire Big Cove campground where the runners have to go back to the gate, it's on a massive incline. Like, I don't know. I mean, I had said maybe it's 7%, 10%, 15% grade at some parts, but I look at my watch. At this point, she's got 3 or 4 minutes left to finish, and she's got like a, what would you say, like a quarter mile, somewhere between 7 and 15% uphill grade at parts to get to the gate and touch it.
Yeah, probably more than, probably like a third of a mile maybe.
So I'm just like, I don't know how she closes with enough time. Like, I think it's, I'm thinking it's going to be one of those tragic Gary Robbins type scenarios where it's like coulda, shoulda, woulda, and just tragedy at the end of this otherwise triumphant effort. I'm just jumping up and down on the road. Her husband's there. These kids kind of run ahead of us. And I think one of them yells to you guys at the gate saying, she's coming, she's coming. And I think you guys were in disbelief. She turns the corner and it was one of those moments. I mean, I wasn't there when Gunhild Swanson did the golden hour finish at Western States 5 or 6 years ago, but it had a lot of those vibes. Mm-hmm. I would say even accelerated. And yeah, I mean, somehow it almost felt like time stood still for her. Like the universe wanted this to happen. And like time just got slower. And obviously she was hustling, she was charging, but things just seemed to work out and touches the gate with like a minute and what, 47 seconds to spare. Yeah. So she closed so fast. And yeah, slumps to the ground. It's just one of those iconic sports moments. And to me, it felt like the greatest moment in ultra running history alongside the greatest performance in ultra running history. So that's my story.
And I think that was the feeling of everybody in camp because, and the second part of my point about her performance is it sort of defied, reality or logic in the sense that we'd all done the math and you don't know where the runner is on Barkley. Like, you know, people are always like, oh, Keith Dunn's tweets, like no one knows what's happening only, but it's like Keith Dunn doesn't even know that much information. And the information that's conveyed out is oftentimes more like when I dropped, people found out that I dropped before my crew found out that
yes,
I dropped.
Yes.
Right. And so when it came to Jasmine finishing, we had found out that she had maybe about 3 hours and 15 minutes or so from Ratjaw. And that's the only part on the course where you know where another runner is. And Ivor, who had won the race, had done that same stretch in 3 hours and 45 minutes. And so we were like, Jasmine is going to have to beat Ihor's time by 30 minutes to get into camp.
Yeah.
Jasmine has had trouble with her stomach all day. She'd had a few issues, and it just seemed impossible that she could beat Ihor by 30 minutes. And it was, you know, best case scenario, people were saying, okay, well, Jasmine's going to be 10 minutes off of the cutoff, and this is going to be like the most tragic finish of all time. And seeing her finish, and finish in the way she did just goes to show Jasmine didn't just run a third of a mile up this crazy steep hill that I, you know, every time I run Barkley, I walk that hill because I'm like, I'm going to save my energy. Like, I don't need to mess with this business. And she came sprinting down that. But the part that, you know, only Jasmine knows and only Jasmine can really understand are the, you know, hours leading up to that, knowing she may or may not break it. The tens of hours leading up, knowing that she may or may not be in that moment.
Yeah.
To be possibly breaking the record by minutes. And then the 60 entire hours of knowing that she has to make this entire course with minimal logistical mistakes to even have a shot of finishing. Like, Jasmine's the only person who's going to know how deep she dug. And to me, I have a lot of admiration for her, of just knowing how hard she had to push for how long she did push.
I got to read this quote from Laz. So Laz put out sort of his initial thoughts post-Barkley on, I guess it was the Ultra Running listserv, which I got to get on. Liam, Aid Station Fireball, sent this to me, which is, it's cool. But on the Jasmine Paris finish, he says, quote, "And then there was the last finisher. Jasmine Paris achieved the impossible. And to achieve the impossible, you have to do the impossible. That stirring, emotion-charged finish is only a fraction of the real story. Jasmine went out too fast. If you want what you want, you have to do what it takes to get it. And what it took to get what she wanted was to go out too fast. And then to transcend human limitations to hang on," end quote. I mean, that just explains it perfectly.
Yeah, we should just get Laz in on this. turns out you just put Laz in on this podcast instead of me, and you're going to get some more quotable content.
but yeah, Drew Darby and I were at the top of Frozen Head Mountain, top of Ratshaw, maybe 4 or 5 hours before the finish. And this was where we were going to kind of make a prediction around, like, A, do they even show up there? B, if and when they show up there, is there enough time left on the clock? And I was trying, I mean, maybe you have the numbers on the top of your head, but how, on that first loop, how fast did you guys close to the gate from Ratshaw?
I don't have a specific number, but I believe it would have been around like 3 hours, 20 minutes, maybe. Like, this is the number in my head. I think I came around Ratshaw around like 5 hours, 10 minutes. And then I came into the aid station around 8:30. I could be 30 minutes off either way, but that would be my guess, is around 3 hours, 20 minutes.
So she had to basically close on par with what she did lap one, because she was in that group when you're fresh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So amazing. And I mean, Drew and I missed her. Like, we got to the top of Ratshaw. We were waiting there for hours on end, saw Eeyore, and then looked at our watches, and there was 3.5 hours, left in the event. And we just kind of were like, you know, at this point, we got to like turn around, walk back down to the car, because we need to get back to the gate to kind of see finishers. It was pretty interesting. As we were walking back down, it's right near that Tub Springs mm-hmm. landmark. We're about a quarter mile from the top of Ratshaw, and there is one other place where, if it's totally serendipitous, you can see the runners crossing that service road to start that last little climb to the top of Ratshaw from the opposite direction. And we happened to catch Jasmine crossing right there. And so she was probably a tenth of a mile from the top of Ratshaw. Mm-hmm. And we kind of caught her by surprise, because we were like, Jasmine, like, because we were just so excited to see her. And it was the one time in the race that we got like emotion out of her, because she was mm-hmm. just very focused on the task at hand. She kind of turned to us and she smiled. And looking back, that ended up being a pretty confirming experience for me, because I remember thinking at the finish line, like, I don't know why I believe this, but I think she's going to finish. And that smile to me in retrospect was kind of like, game on. Like, I'm in this. Like, I don't know if it's possible, but by smiling to you, I'm just confirming that, like, I'm still mentally in it, and it could still be in the cards. Like, let's see. Like, I'm willing to try.
Yeah.
Five finishers this year.
Big crew, big squad.
Can you put perspective around that? Because I think when people think five finishers, they think, oh my gosh, the Barkley's been solved. Like, this is no longer as difficult as it's being portrayed. Or maybe, you know, Laz and Carl have lost a step, and like, just people are figuring it out. So,
turns out Barkley's easy now.
Turns out Barkley's.
Yeah.
What do you think?
That's kind of the end of the interview. I think we're good. No, it's an interesting question, right? Like, the course is harder than last year. The thing people don't get about Barkley is a little bit of moisture goes a really long way. And there are other things other than moisture, which include fog, briars, night loop versus day loop, and start time that can significantly have moderate impacts on the performance of runners. But any kind of moisture is a, you know, anywhere from 2% to 40 to 50% kind of like performance decrease.
Yeah.
Decreaser. And typically it's more like a probably like 20, maybe like 15 to 30% decrease in performance if you get a good rainstorm. So that is the historic weather context is the last 2 years have been perfectly clear. The previous 5 years had been really crappy. If you look at the, what's his name? The finishers, who's the photographer who has the finishers?
Alexis Berg.
Thank you.
Alexis Berg.
Yeah. So if you look at his like, coffee table book, it just looks like the most harrowing, scary, crazy, wild. There's fog everywhere. Everyone's mud covered. It just looks like barbaric and brutal and primitive. My two experiences, I've only been there the last 2 years, is it's like pretty nice. It's pretty, you know, pretty great weather. And that's what's helped people. There were three finishers last year. There were five finishers this year. And then previously in those other 5 years, there were zero finishers. So if you look way back in the day, there was a squad with Jared and I believe it was Luke Nelson. And they did like a 10 and a half hour loop one because it was just horrible weather. Whereas, yeah, most years someone's doing like an 8:30 loop one. So anyway, that's the historical context. Have Laz and Carl lost a step. That's the hard thing about Barkley, which is sort of like a chicken and the egg situation, is like if Laz makes it, let's say Laz adds 10 minutes of course to Barkley this year. That totals 50 minutes.
50 minutes.
That basically means Ihor is the only person. I think that would mean Ihor would be the only finisher this year.
Yeah.
And you'd be saying, wow, like Laz and Carl putting this race together where, you know, 10 of the best multi-day athletes are out there and four of them came in within a half hour of the finish and we'd be totally having a different conversation right now. And that's on like a perfect weather year, right? So if he adds 10 more... If he adds 10 more minutes, of course, then it changes the whole ball game. And that assumes you've gotten like ideal, perfect springtime conditions. So I think that's the thing that will be interesting. And in this last year, when you think of like, okay, well, how did Laz respond to three people finishing Barkley? There were a lot of people who were like, man, Carl and Laz are just going to like lay down the hammer. They're going to make a new course. It's going to be miserable. And I dropped so early, I got to talk with Laz and hear Carl kind of process everybody going through the course. And they're kind of, their take was everyone went out so hard on loop one, no one's going to finish. Like they were saying, yeah, the course is harder this year. No one's going to finish.
Yeah.
And then once loop three came around, Laz was pretty outspoken about thinking that there would be finishers this year. But it took him that extra, you know, two loops to fully feel, kind of change his tune to the chances of people finishing. And he didn't change the course last year in a way that was dramatically harder. And so now the worry is for next year, not the worry, but the conundrum is like, do you make it harder and make it entirely impossible to finish in any kind of, you know, in anything but perfectly sunny weather? Or do you have a little bit of like wiggle room, change some of the course, make it to be books and terrain that people get lost at or have a harder time finding, and have a little bit more wiggle room for finishing time and maybe have it come down a little bit more to orienteering or route finding or knowledge of the area?
A couple things come to mind. As you mentioned, four of the five finishers this year finished with 30 minutes or less to spare. And the reason I bring that up is because Drew and I found this out as we were leaving Ratjaw to go see the finish, but he had accidentally left his phone up there. So as soon as the race ends, we're making that hike, that 3 mile hike up the Forest Service Road to get back to Ratjaw to go pick it up. As that's happening, this is an hour after the race, starts to downpour. And the first thing, Drew and I look at each other and we're just like, if this downpour had started at hour 57 or 58 or 59 of the race, we might be only talking about one finisher this year, like you said, Ihor.
Mm-hmm.
So the weather piece I thought was significant that it held to just enough. Like we might not be talking about Jasmine, Jared, Greg, John. That's the first thing. Other thing I would say is look at the composition of the finishers. Jared and John are two of the greats of all time, right? Like they over-prepare. Like nobody prepares harder than those two. Greg is a multi-time fun runner and kind of finally broke through this year. Jasmine is a fun runner, multiple years of relative success, finally broke through this year. The only person that I feel like anybody besides Jasmine maybe would be surprised about is Eeyore. Like he's a virgin, comes in, nails it, spends a couple laps in the lead and doing some navigation himself. Like that, I mean, I'm sure you can talk more to that, but that blew me away. That he had that confidence, and then not just the confidence, but the ability to find books and like be on his own.
Well, it reminds me of Aurelien last year, because Aurelien Sanchez is a French runner and he finished Barkley. He was the first, weirdly the first finisher of the group. And I remember everybody was thinking like, oh, well, loop five, like you kind of work as a team to loop four. And then on loop five, it's sort of in the spirit of Barkley. I mean, John Kelly's a total hardo and I love him for it. And he was left with Greg Hamilton, but, and he was like, but I didn't navigate with Greg because that wouldn't be in the spirit of loop five, which I was like, go get him, John, like keep Barkley alive. And but that's the kind of like perception shift, right? It's like, yeah, you can work together for four loops and then at some point you need to leave the nest and do your own thing. And Aurelien did that and finished. And everybody was just like, what?
Yeah.
Shot. And then you see Eeyore do it a second year. And I've had that experience where I left the nest, thought I could do it. And then, you know, my wings were not fully developed and I crashed hard and died. And it's just very, it's very impressive to see people on their first run do something like that. And it's weird that, yeah, both times when people have done that, it's been people who ended up winning, you know, being the best runner out there on the day.
Yeah. It also shocked me, by the way, that like, and I knew this like academically in the sense that I followed the race and you can kind of see what, where importance is placed and what people value and what people don't really care about. It was cool to see sort of in the flesh there that every single runner, I mean, probably Jasmine was rightly celebrated the most, but like from like a placing standpoint, the fact that they finished first, second, third, fourth, fifth, that meant nothing. It was just purely the celebration of a finish that mattered the most.
Other than Eeyore got to sit down earlier than the other runners.
Yeah.
That was probably the biggest gift Eeyore got for finishing first.
But we're not really talking about like the second place finisher at the Barkley Marathons. It's just like one of the finishers.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, that's kind of the, you know, my crew person Witt is a longtime multi-day runner, and he came away from this event being like, wow, I'd like kind of fallen out of love with ultra marathon running because it's grown as this professionalized sport. And it's like, yeah, just it doesn't have quite as much grassroots community feel as he had kind of like seen or been used to. And then being at Barkley kind of reinvigorated that in him. And I think that goes to, yeah, that just speaks to kind of like the whole event, right? Which starts from the finishers and the fact that like, yeah, if you finish, it's not because you're an army of one and you conquered Barkley. It's because you've had people who've mentored you to get there or to took you under their wing to help you find the right books or turnoffs for the books. It's because you've had people organizing the event that make it intentionally harder and harder for you to finish and that want to push you and want to see you fail so that when you do succeed, you understand kind of the importance and meaning and value of success and also learning that failure isn't a bad thing. And then it comes down to the crew and the people who are there in just a very small community kind of driven, tight-knit way where, yeah, people have each other's backs. You know, you're literally hanging out in a campground in the middle of nowhere for 2.5 days with nothing to do other than to like wait every 12 hours for somebody to come dirty and out of the woods to get a blister popped, get a, you know, freeze pop in their mouth. Actually, for a butternut blaster for John Kelly, a McFlurry or a Sonic shake, and then get back out there.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, because, and again, this was my first year, so I was just kind of getting the lay of the land. I was surprised by how much time the runners on the third, fourth, and fifth laps spent in that sort of corral area next to the gate doing all of their crewing. And with the exception of, you know, Jared leaving briefly to go shower, I think John left to maybe sleep for a little bit, but he came back. the vast majority of the time, these runners were not exiting to go back to their campsites or crews to like recover or reset. Like, it was all being done there. And two things for me kind of struck me. A, I had just always been under this impression from watching like the Ethan Newberry documentary that like you spent like, I don't know, upwards of like 30 to 60 minutes in those later stage transitions, like with your crew, maybe sleeping, and like someone's got an alarm clock going and they, you know, get you back up again. I saw much quicker turnarounds. And then also just like, it was shocking to me that these people spend all this time in extreme solitude for the majority of the 60 hours. And when they do come back, they're under our microscope. Like, we're just like hanging over the fence, snapping photos, you know, taking video, like, you know, yelling words of encouragement. Like, it was all pretty positive, but like, they're under the microscope. Like, mm-hmm. they have no chance to like have a private moment of recovery. It's just like a Coliseum scenario where like, it's just all eyes on them. Like, I could see Jasmine, like, at times like wanting to throw up or nod off. And
well, she threw up right before loop five.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Or did something. I don't know did what the end result was.
Did but. Something. But I just like, a part of me felt so bad. I was like, man, like, you can't even like you keep, in a sense, it's its own focus where you have to like kind of be, if you want, like self-aware of like what's around you.
But you don't care, right? I think that's, and
I hope not.
I would say it's different for everybody. I'd say like, you know, one, I'd say that the farthest angle is like Jasmine and I talked about this, is it's like, it's very lonely. Like, doing Barkley is very lonely. You're just out there for 60 hours. You might be with people for a little bit, but it's a very solitary experience. And so even just having people watch you, like you're kind of an animal in a cage, is like a social experience, right? And you're getting that experience with people. Some people may see that as a good thing, or some people may see that as a bad thing. I generally see that as a good thing, because I always think anything like this is just kind of like silly.
Yeah.
Like, Barkley is silly. Any multi-day ultra is very silly. And the whole experience is silly. So you might as well make it silly and continue to kind of live into the silliness of the event. So for me, it's like, yeah, go frickin' like throw up on a frickin' concrete road in the middle of a campground, eat your like butternut blaster sonic shake, like pop a blood blister and have like a little bit of blood squirt onto the tarmac, and everybody's just there watching everything happen. But when you're running, you're out there for so long and you have this kind of like short, you know, 15 to 30 minute window. To me, yeah. I don't mind the sort of like spectator experience. And I think that is also why, I think one of the reasons that works is because it's just such a small event. Like,
yeah.
The time when I don't agree with that and where it rubs me the wrong way is when it gets night out and you have, you know, there's 20 media people that are there. If you have 15 with, you know, high flash cameras, and, you know, there's three people flashing bulbs right into your eyeballs when you're just trying to hang out and, you know, huff down some mashed potato and chicken.
Yeah.
Like, that isn't a good experience. So to me, it is all about like human decency and like the fact that people who are spectating should be part of the experience in a positive way and uplift the other runners. Although that being said, like, that kind of experience could also be like a zoo in a cage type experience if people are disrespectful, or if there are too many people, or if media want to get too involved. Like, one of the great things about Barkley that I think has changed, that's for the worse, is, you know, people used to not really have crews. Like, crews are a somewhat newer concept.
New generation.
Yeah. And the reason that happens is because as people would DNF, the people who DNF become the crews for the previous runners. And that creates a different kind of bond and environment and relationship with people. And that's something that I think is like, yeah, the core of Barkley, it would be awesome to have that be, you know, how the race is run. Obviously, that's probably not going to happen. But that type of community vibe is very positive, where like somebody shoving a GoPro and, you know, somebody, like, I saw multiple people out there with a GoPro and like a DSLR holding both right in people's faces. And you're like, can you give people like 3 feet, right? Like, that type of space or respect is something that gets lost a little bit.
Also, thank you to Rabbit, the official apparel partner of Singletrack. If you're listening to this in mid to late March, spring is here. And like me, you're probably switching out your running wardrobe as temperatures get warmer.
two pieces of gear that I have been turning to recently. The first is Rabbit's Speedster X Running Tight. Super lightweight, quick drying, made with materials that fight bacteria and eliminate odor. Super comfortable. But my favorite component is it's got these two side stash pockets that fit my phone and nutrition with minimal to no bounce. The other is Rabbit's Switchback Tee, which I love for many reasons, including the awesome colorways, but it's also got this semi-relaxed fit for cling-free performance. And yeah, for listeners of the podcast, we've got a great discount for you. If you're interested, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout on their website for 20% off your next order. With that, let's get back to this conversation with Joe McConaughey.
While we're on the topic of like that corral area and crew scene, well, the first thing I should say is I expected Barkley to be this very grim, serious, solemn experience, even for like the crew and media and Laz. Like I was really thinking like, I'm going to show up, I'm going to document with Drew, and it's just going to be this very serious thing. I never laughed more in those like 3 days with like you, Wit, Drew, Laz, Carl than I had at any other event. It was so much fun. And even though there was so much at stake and you were like totally tuned into like the heroic efforts that these runners were making, we always found you guys are very good at finding ways to like throw light on the situation. And one story that comes to mind for me, so you might be able to tell this better than me because you have really good delivery, but it was maybe between lap 3 and 4, and Jared is coming into the corral and his wife Mindy is there who's crewing him. And we were just, you and I were just going back and forth all like week with just like old obscure movie and commercial references. And the one that I came up with for Jared was He Went to Jared, which for anybody, if I can find it, maybe we can throw the commercial on YouTube into the episode. But there's this like jewelry commercial out there called He Went, the tagline is He Went to Jared, Jared, the Gallery of Jewelry. And it came to mind because Jared is such a legend in the space that if you're at Barkley and you're like a virgin or even, you know, relatively new to the event, you kind of latch on. You go to Jared. You go to Jared. You
kind of latch on. I've gone to Jared many times. Yeah.
Joe's gone to Jared. And anyways, like Joe and I were just like laughing so hard about that reference. Like we would see someone like come in with Jared and I'd be like, he went to Jared. And like it's maybe like what, like 1 in the morning, yep. And Jared comes in to get crewed by Mindy and Joe just like screams out, he went to Jared. And like it's just prior to that it was just like totally silent, everyone's like keyed in, like the cameras and are everywhere, it's just totally like, and you just break the ice and Mindy just bursts out laughing so hard.
She did laugh, she did not laugh at a later point. But we ran out of magic with Mindy, but that's okay. But I think that's, I don't know, that wasn't the, I feel like it's probably different every year and it depends on who's there. Because it's, it is like sometimes a very somber event.
Yeah.
I feel like I feel like as a participant, you are able to sort of transcend that space of yeah. like, kind of just like I wasn't talking smack, but I just like, I'm going to have fun. Like I'm going to try to make it fun for the runners. And I've been there where you get in on a lap and it's just like stone cold silent. And it's like, it's so weird.
Yeah.
I've spent 12 hours being totally alone and now I'm surrounded by 30 people and no one, it's just as silent other than like a camera clicking and like someone shuffling. So to me, it was really important to have fun and have a good time. But I don't know if that's like the experience every year. I think it is. I think it can be actually pretty somber. I'm not going to take credit for making it like a rambunctious time, but I will say
I had so we much did fun. Have a blast. I had so yeah. much fun. I think what kicked it off for me was the first night of Barkley. So for those that aren't familiar, Laz can blow the conch anytime between 11 p.m. and 11 a.m. So this 12-hour window on the first day of the event. And when he blows the conch, that means that runners have an hour to get ready before the race starts. And Drew and I, from the moment 11 p.m. starts the night before, we're just locked in. Like, we're sitting in camp because we're trying to make this movie about Joe. And we just think it's absolutely necessary that we're staying awake until Laz blows that conch so we can get that shot. And it's just a key kind of, you know, cinematic part of the content we're creating. And I just had to start laughing because I just immediately recognized how much this could be, like, Laz could enjoy this part of the event as much as he enjoys seeing these runners try to survive this course and inflict pain on themselves to complete laps. Like, he loved fucking with the crew and the media. It was a frigid cold night. 2 a.m. comes around. I'm in like 7 layers of winter clothes. I'm still finding a way to be totally freezing, like going borderline hypothermic. Laz, that guy has amazing stamina.
He does.
Like, through the night, he was just like getting so high off of our uncertainty and impatience and pain. You know, Drew and I are like sitting around the fire with a couple other crew members and trying to stay warm. Laz gets up from his tent, walks over, you know, he'll make some remark like, I don't know why you idiots are hanging around. I'll let you know when I blow the conch. And so just the humor began there. It was so sadistic. And then the funny thing was, you know, at 3 a.m., Drew and I just finally give up. We're like, you know what? Like, it's not worth it. We'll find a way to just like recapture the sound of the conch and overlay some, you know, midnight image of the camp. We'll call it a day. 5 minutes later, we think we hear the conch. It turns out it's an eerily similar car alarm.
Yeah.
So we rush up to camp. Carl's like, nah, false alarm. We go back to bed. 5 minutes later, the real conch blows. So we missed it. It was so funny.
Well, Whit was standing next to Carl, or Whit was standing next to Laz and to Carl. And Carl comes up and he's like, I'm sorry. Did I miss it? And he's like, no, like, it wasn't the real conch. Like, it hasn't blown. He's like, oh, okay. Wow, that's crazy how close it is to race time. So Whit actually knew, like, he'd heard him say that and was like, oh, wait a sec. The conch is about to get blown here. Oh my. Isn't that wild? I know. I was like, man, Whit just, like, is infiltrating the inner circle over here while already. Everybody else is sleeping or getting frigid. And
we should give a shout out to Whit, too, because one of my favorite experiences from the week was hanging out with Whit, who is one of the more interesting people in the sport. Talk about why you picked him for your crew and just kind of what makes him fun to be around.
Yeah, so Whit hit me up to coach him in 2020, and I was excited because he'd done well at some multi-day stuff and had an Arizona Trail FKT under his belt, and he's a thru hiker, so it was really fun working with him. Then I was doing the Arizona Trail, and I just hit him up and was like, hey, dude, you have a van and you're pretty fun. Do you want to come crew the Arizona Trail? And he's one of the few people who's nomadic enough that he can just do that, and did it at the drop of a hat. And then that really created like kind of like an inseparable or unrelenting friendship between the two of us, which has been nice. So Whit is one of those people. And the Arizona Trail, if you've crewed like a multi-day FKT, then you have been in the trenches and you know the gist. If you're like the head person crewing, like Jordan Hamm is one of those people.
Yeah.
Katie is one of those people. Whit is one of those people where just like, I'll trust you to the moon and back. And especially they know how I operate.
Right? Yeah.
Like they know who I am as a runner and what makes me tick and what I need and what I don't need. So Whit is, anytime I'm doing any event ever, you know, Whit's like at the top of the list.
Yeah.
One of the people at the top of the list for doing this. And the things that's nice about him, he is an EMT. So he's got all the medical stuff down. He has done multi-day FKTs, so he understands sleep strategy. He understands nutrition. He has just like this Southern charm to him. He's from Atlanta, so he just has this like pastor-like presence that's just like brings you in and is just very calming and soothing and also fun. He has a wild past where he was in a band called The Wild. Shout out. If you want to listen to them, you might help get Whit a few extra dollars at the end of the year to pay for his bills. It's also a great band. They're like a folk punk band. And he toured for like 7 years with them. And he's just like an all-around person to be around. And he's also not afraid to like pop. He's popped more blisters on my feet than I probably have. So he isn't afraid to get dirty, knows what he's doing. And it's just like a great positive presence to have at a race like this. You know, there aren't really much I could say about like, yeah, he's like the crew archetype of like, you know, the ideal. He's like crew Jesus is kind of who Whit is.
I mean, my first impression was walking over to your van and you're sitting in one of the camp chairs in front of it. And like Chef Boyar Whit Wisebrand like walks out. He's made you like curried chicken, butternut squash, like garden salad, and like this, what was the drink you had with like the straw?
Oh, mate.
And yeah, like a really like sophisticated mate combination. Yeah. Like, oh my gosh.
It was a mango mate. Oh. Yeah.
And then like, you know, by the time you're doing all like the, you know, here's my plan for lap one, lap two, he's got this like notepad out and there's like diagrams on it and like all sorts of like nanosecond timing for when hand up. I'm just like, oh my God. But yeah, like a couple of, I mean, one of the cool things about Barkley is there's so much downtime between laps and you're just there with people and you have to kill time and you get to know people super well. Also neighbors with Ricky Gates in Santa Fe, has guided with Andrew Skurka in some crazy places. Has been to like 500 Fish concerts.
That was the thing he was probably most excited about. I actually never heard how he talked to Keith Dunn about Fish.
Oh, they did.
Oh, they did. No, okay, totally, that's good to hear.
Yeah,
that's great to hear. What did they talk? Did they like go at it, or was it?
It was just like favorite shows, favorite songs. Whether Trey is to blame for all of the past drama in the band. You know, what eras were best? Are, you know, are we in like a downtime right now? Like, are we in enough time? Stuff like that. Yeah.
So if you're listening, basically, Keith Dunn, who's the guy, who's the Twitter voice guy, the only way you can spectate Barkley is to literally follow this guy on, sorry, X, the rebrand. And he's on X and he has like 100,000 followers. I don't know how many followers he has. And he is the only person, he sort of has the noose on media during the event. So the only person who's divulging information publicly is Keith. And he just like is this kind of older gentleman. He has dyed, like lightly dyed purple hair, like weirdly lightly dyed. Like it could be a little darker. If it was like purple, you could make it more purple. It's like an odd, lightly purpled color. And on his Twitter, he tweets about Barkley. And for the other 363 days, he tweets about Fish. And that was what Witt was possibly most excited for going to this race.
A couple other people that I talked to a bunch. One was Howie Stern, the photographer, who I have found to be encyclopedic in his knowledge of the sport and the history of this event. One thing we were talking about a lot was how difficult it is for somebody who is sub-elite to finish this event and how much weight he puts on John Fegversi's finish here maybe 7 or 8 years ago, because John is admittedly like a middle-of-the-pack to back-of-the-pack runner. And the way he completed Barkley was he basically even splitted every single lap. He was doing every single lap of Barkley in about 12 hours, like an hour under each lap cutoff, and ended up finishing in what, like 59 and change or something.
Yep.
So that's one of the most interesting performances of all time, thanks to Howie for that. And Laz was trying to debate me on like what constitutes mid-pack, and he was trying to throw like Andrew Thompson and Jonathan Bashman in those categories. And I was like, I don't consider them mid-pack. Like they're like, their resumes are stout in a lot of different ways. But yeah, like just, it was just, you just had so much time to kill, and I felt like I picked up a lot of, in that time, you kind of identify interesting people, and you spend a lot of time getting like lowdowns on just really cool topics.
I talked with Laz about Cherokee quartzite for like 30 minutes, and I was like, which is a type of rock prominent in, I want to say like Wisconsin, perhaps, that he's experienced on his transcon. And you kind of get, that's the funny thing with Barkley, is you're kind of like in these circles, and you're in these like conversation loops. That it's almost like a Sims game where you're like, okay, I'm going to go talk to the last character for 30 minutes. Okay, this is getting a little old now. I'm going to go talk to the Keith Dunn character. I'm going to go back and make and like put up an egg and eat an egg. Okay, I ate my egg. I'm going to go talk to the Finn character and see what this Finn character is. And there's like nothing really happening during the whole 12 hours other than like, oh, are there any updates? Nope, there are no updates. Okay, go back to your little sim life for another 12 hours. Yeah, it's a wild space to be in.
Yeah. Let's talk about your race.
Sure.
Last year, obviously, a fun run. In my opinion, a really impressive debut. Talk about this one. Where do you want to start?
It was over pretty quick.
Yeah.
At the end. We're done. That's about the whole race. No, it was a crazy year. I went in with high expectations, knew the weather was good, was feeling like the am I going to be finisher number 18 vibe going in, and then was sorely disappointed. So, but it's all good. It was a tough race. It was a really interesting pack because there were about 18 people. about halfway through loop one. I was just like in the back on loop one. I had to go back because I like the hardest thing about Barkley is like you need to poop. You're out there and there's no trail, so you don't know where people are. So if you like need to go out and do a bathroom break, people aren't going to be on the trail. They're going to be anywhere in the woods, which means you can't just go and there's no privacy, right? Like if you jump off to the side, then
there is no side.
There is no side. Exactly. There's no side. And so I had like, man, I really,
there is no spoon.
I really, yeah, exactly. I was like, I really need to take a pit stop. And I just like held it for like 4 hours. Cause I was like, okay, I need to like
prairie dog it.
I know. And, I finally went and like let the whole group pass. And that was the only way I could do it. I let all like the entire group, cause we were all in this one condensed group, pass. And then I caught back up to people and then I started counting people and I realized there were about 18 individuals after about like 4 hours of running, which is absurd. That's like has to be the most condensed pack in a Barkley race of all time. Laz commented in the same thing you read in that there might be some testosterone poisoning might be a major cause for slowdown because people being too excited in the front throwing down the pace and ruining the race. So I went out. I knew I didn't want to be in the lead pack. I stuck back a little bit and felt like I was running my race. I was doing a good job of like stopping at all the intersections, trying to remember all the new books. And I felt pretty happy with what I was doing. I was working hard trying to get food down. And then coming down Ratjaw, I passed Jasmine. Jasmine and I shared a lap, a little over a lap on the previous year. So I chatted with her a little bit. She had just tweaked her ankle. So I kept running down. And after I passed her, I then did like a full on like banana split through my poles, rolled my ankle. And then Jasmine was kind enough to pick my poles up and give them back to me and kept going. Then you fast forward to the next lap. At the very beginning of lap two, I rolled my ankle a second time and ended up that kind of being the cause of my my DNF, where I just had no strength or power on the uphills.
Let's come back to the ankle in a second. I found the quote around the testosterone poisoning. Laz says, a pack of 18 took on the first loop together. Usually that results in testosterone poisoning as they beat each other to death. This time, the best navigators led the group, and they collectively used brute force to defeat the new books. It doesn't require precise navigation to locate a book when 18 people fan out over the place that it's at. In military terms, it was the equivalent of a full frontal assault. Casualties were expected, but there were so many elite runners, the course could not kill them all.
That's basically what happened. I mean, there were just so many strong people out there. People started splitting up once we got to Ratjaw, but yeah, there's like, and that's the hardest thing. You asked me before the race of like, oh, what would success look like? What would failure look like? And my failure response to the failure point would be like, oh, failure would look like if I wasn't able to go and give it what I wanted to give it. And that's kind of what happened because of my ankle. So, that like kind of sums up my race in a nutshell, where I ended up dropping after about 12 hours, a hike uphill section off trail section that I thought would have taken about 45 minutes took about 2 hours. And when that happened, I decided I probably should just get back to camp and not mess my ankle up anymore.
It's tough because you can't really control, like injuries aren't really something you can control for.
Yes. True.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking like in terms of, are there any other thing, like, cause are you going to go back?
Probably. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know about next year. I need to do some soul searching for next year.
Okay.
But yes, I do feel like I would love to give the course another go.
What would make you not want to go back? Like what's uncertain for you in terms of motivation?
Oh, just it's a weird time of year. I have so many things that I want to do.
Yeah.
And it's one of the few races where it's like a swing and a miss type thing, where it could be this like brutal, harrowing highlight of your year, or it could just be like, you know, a few pennies in the bucket, which is what it is for me for this year, where I'm like, okay, did Barkley, not really worried that it's going to affect doing Coca Dona in 2 months. Like it happened, but it's not that big of a deal. Or if I was out there for 60 hours, I might be going into Coca Dona being like, God, like my metabolism's, my hormones are fried. Yep. I like tweaked my knee and I battled it out for 15 hours and I need to recover from that. I lost a ton of like muscle strength and speed and I need to get my legs back. For me, I'm just kind of like, okay, basically just did like a hard, disappointing training run and now I'm back for Cocodona. So if I didn't have Cocodona on my calendar right now, I think I would like look at Barkley being like, well, there was the race of the year.
Yeah.
And my year's over and it's March. And the flip side of that is like, if you need to prepare for Barkley, like it's the race of the year, is that affects your, basically like you take out May through November and bulldoze it so that you're going to do well at Barkley.
One last break to mention a new partner that I am really excited about, and that is Delta G Ketones. You've heard me talk about and support the use of ketones in performance settings like ultramarathons many times over the last couple of years. I've personally included exogenous ketones in my own training and racing during that stretch. And after taking roughly 6 months to do more research in this area of nutrition, particularly since last August, what turned me on to Delta G was that its products allow individuals to achieve deep states of ketosis safely and immediately in both performance and recovery contexts. I'll have much more to add about how and why I use Delta G in future episodes later this spring, but one of the biggest reasons I support this company is because, again, it's the only products out there that get individuals to achieve these beneficial levels of ketosis safely. So if you're interested and want to check out their range of products, I encourage you to visit their website, deltagketones.com. And if you end up making a purchase, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout for 20% off your next order. With that, let's get back to this conversation with Joe Stringbean McConaughey.
I'm sure there are some people, well, actually, I should backtrack. The reason I want to ask questions about training, nutrition, sort of the mental side of things, the navigation side of things, is because just being there for 3 days made me fall in love with this event. Like, I have whatever it is, the Barkley bug. I don't know what they call it. Like, I have been stricken, and at the very least, I want to keep going back to this event in a media capacity on repeat, if not to crew someone next year or to start doing the Barkley Fall Classic and applying and, you know, trying to make a loop or a fun run, whatever. And I've just been like on the flight here to Seattle from Knoxville a couple days ago. Like, before the flight, I just basically downloaded like all of John Kelly's blogs ever on the event. Downloaded Jared Campbell's blogs on the event. We'll link to some of them in the show notes. And started like looking into training philosophy and stuff. Jared has some funny ones. He says, when I'm getting ready for Barkley, there are three metrics, there are three buckets that I evaluate myself on to kind of determine whether I'm ready for this event. The first one is time spent in inclement weather, time spent accumulating vert, and time spent bushwhacking. And he has this whole philosophy called conditioned optimism, where he tries to do all of these outdoor activities that combine all three. And like, he'll be staring out his window, you know, in the Salt Lake Park City area, and he'll see like hail and just spitting rain at the bottom of Granger Peak. He'll see like a foot of snow accumulated at the top. And he has conditioned himself to be like, hell yes. Like, cannot wait to get out the door. I'm going to go rack up 24K of vert and, you know, check in the box for, you know, one more day of sort of like getting hardened for Barkley. Obviously, like, you're one of the most physically talented runners in this race every year. I would also say mentally too, like, just getting to know you, like, you just have such like a great attitude towards life. Do you think there's multiple ways to skin a cat here? Like, do you think?
Oh, I think there's unlimited ways to skin a cat. I mean, yeah. This is my whole like premise with ultramarathon running to begin with, is that it's like all pseudoscience anyway.
The voodoo magic.
Yeah, the voodoo magic. Exactly, right? Yeah. So the joke is, it's like marathon running is like a science, ultramarathon running is like a pseudoscience, and multi-day events are like black voodoo magic. You know, it's like, who knows? Sure, Joe, that's...
Where's our dollars? Pin the...
Yeah, so either I just threw all my like professional credibility as a coach out the window, or I probably just did that, but that's fine. People can say what they want. So my take...
They reach out to, they're like... Yeah. Like, do you like voodoo magic? Exactly.
We can practice. I'm like, if you want to finish Barkley, you need to get this tattoo. Then you need to murder a cat and hang it outside of your back window. No. Anyway, for preparing for the Barkley, like, you get different opinions from everybody. Like, Brian Robinson, Flying Brian, he finished it back in the day, and his thing was like, all you should do is like spend as much. He took Jared and Jared's philosophy, and it's just like, all you need to do is spend every waking spare minute you have getting like straight up crazy vertical gain vert that's like at least 30% grade. And I think that's the general mindset of training for this kind of thing. I don't think you need to do that to like do well. I mean, coming from the guy who's had two average performances. So, but to me, I don't think you need to do that to do well at Barkley. I think it's one of those of any type of multi-day event is like a culmination of your like lifelong trajectory as an endurance athlete and how well you perform in a variety of metrics. One, you know, knowing, having appropriate prerequisite experience of like knowing how you do in sleep deprivation.
Yep.
Having some innate qualities that maybe it's innate or maybe it's learned, but of just like handling and coping with mental and physical stress in a way that's sustainable and that allows you to continue pushing on. Having a incredibly strong ability to climb and to push, which going uphill mostly comes down to like your engine and your pure physical capacity to do something like this. And then it also comes down to your downhill climbing ability and how well you can absorb, you know, thousands of feet of downhill and still have usable quads.
Yep.
And then having a navigational aspect of your training. So being able to get from point A to point B. And you saw that with Damian Hall this year, where shout out to Damian RIP for two sad navigational blunders on loop five. But you know, that's like a prerequisite of not a prerequisite, but that's the skill set that composes the training to get you there.
The Damian example, and we had a chance to hang out with Damian actually in the Knoxville airport. We just happened to run into him
afterwards.
What an awesome dude. Yeah, like all the physical talent in the world. He was so mentally seemingly with it when we saw him at Ratshaw, each of the checkpoints, like cracking jokes. Remember that the
joke? I know, the tea time joke. He liked that one. So that's good.
Just a great guy. But yeah, like it's like the Damian example is like Barkley is this thing where it for a time it does reward togetherness and collaboration and sort of this leader follower dynamic. But then at another time in the race, it doesn't just reward, it mandates individuality and self-sufficiency and like individual competence in all categories. And that blew me away too.
Yeah. It's a full mix. And the thing I think when it comes down to from a training perspective that maybe drills in the fitness side of it a little bit more is like the thing you notice about people who do well at Barkley is, everybody can climb well for 4 hours. Everybody can climb well for 8 hours. And certain people are just able to sustain climbing well at hour 20, hour 30, hour 40, and hour 50. And that's, you know, I think where a lot of people, that's maybe where like the mid-packers separate.
Yeah.
Where you might look at somebody perhaps like Feggy or perhaps somebody else where you're like, he just has a hard time, you know, he doesn't have that like fitness and ability like Damian does, where Damian could do, you know, another 20,000 more feet of vert, you know, after Barkley and probably still be on his 2 feet and climbing at a sustainable rate that'll allow him to finish. And that probably is like the most, that's probably like the skill or ability that anyone looking to training for Barkley needs to, you know, try their best, you know, to however you train that, at having that ability and skill and fitness.
It reminds me, because this was right after the first lap when you guys all just came in at this torrent pace. I tap Laz on the shoulder and I'm like, Laz, pretty much everybody in that lead group looks pretty messed up, don't you think? And he turns to me, he's like, I actually think they look pretty good. And because I had, my reference point was like the sort of the finality of a 100-mile race where like people can go out too hard, look pretty wrecked, but like they're going to kind of at least survive if they want to like that, whatever, like 24-hour finish. And by comparison at Barkley, what my perception of wrecked is just the beginning of this 5-lap quest. And in the context of that, they actually look pretty good. Which blew me away. It was it was pretty funny.
Yeah, but that's what's so amazing, right? Like, you see John Kelly was the most obvious example of this. John Kelly would get into camp, and he, like, couldn't walk downhill. Like, He's a little pigeon-toed to begin with, and like you just see him walking down and you're like, this poor guy is like about to fall over and have a leg fall off. And then he goes out and rips, you know, two more loops and just crushes ups and downs the whole time. And it's comical just because you see somebody in like this, what feels like pain.
Yeah.
And you know, their like feet are mangled and look horrible and are uncomfortable. And there's this big difference. And I've experienced this too. It's like when you're in camp, when you know it's easy, when you know it's supposed to hurt, it's like ripping off a Band-Aid. And then once you get rip off the Band-Aid and are back on the loop, you're back to the John Kelly of old. Of, I mean, I'm sure he didn't look that, you know, like a total fresh buck going up and down. But yeah, where you're able to crush 2,000-foot climb after 2,000-foot climb and descent.
After Jasmine, he was the most impressive finish to me because he looked the most wrecked, like in the third and the fourth laps. And, you know, shout out to Gary Robbins, who was his sort of crew chief there, kind of shepherding him through the transition processes. But what a gritty performance.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was fun. It's fun to see John do well. I mean, it's fun to see anyone do well is really what it is. But yeah, it's just super cool.
It's crazy to see each of these people, like all of their thoughts and feelings distilled into the most simple, basic human emotions and what each person looks like in their, you know, pre-race camp version self versus this. Somehow, some way, Jared kind of looked the same.
He just chilled out.
Jared, yeah, I don't know, like, what. Maybe what Jared would say if you just saw behind the face, like I was just like everybody else, but he still managed to look awesome and competent even at lap five. Like, I mean, one of the most emotional moments for me was in that 4-5 transition when he and Jasmine got to the gate right around the same time. Or maybe he got in a little bit after Jasmine, but Jasmine was kind of struggling, you know, with stomach issues and just general fatigue. And yeah, he walks up and sort of just provides one of the ultimate examples of just being a class act by, you know, allowing Jasmine to take the clockwise route. He takes counterclockwise, and that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Maybe a couple more things before we close up. The first one, just the nutritional element. I think some people might be curious, is there anything different about Barkley that you have to plan for from like a nutritional standpoint and like making sure the gut is kind of working for you instead of against you throughout the race?
I'd say that it's often multi-day events are easier because you have more margins to play with where you can like eat less and be okay. You know, Jasmine's a good, I don't know how much Jasmine ate, but I imagine it was below. There are significant periods where she's below like 200 calories an hour or something. Yeah. That being said, it is like a torrent of food where you're like, okay, like, yeah, 24, 48 hours. Am I really going to get 300 calories, you know? And am I really going to get like 15,000 calories over 2 days, you know? Yeah. Like, that's a lot of food to eat if you're doing 300 calories an hour. But it's I'd say that's the hardest thing. It's just like having food and having sort of a process where you're eating efficiently over the course of the event. And everybody does it a little bit differently. Like, I don't think there's anybody on the course who, I don't think there was anyone who had like identical nutrition strategies. You know, we were joking that John Kelly looks like he got sponsored by the Dollar General because it looks like he had like 10 minutes to grab whatever sweets he could from Dollar General and put them in his pack. You know, Jasmine had like boiled potatoes and other things that were kind of like home cooked. Conrad like made this like beautiful like pasta for her that just looked great.
Yeah.
Everybody has their different strategies and approaches that'll work for them. But ultimately, you know, you got to be getting a lot of food down. And for me, one of the crucial things is like most people don't think about protein. But when you do a multi-day event, like protein comes into play. And it's often what throws people for the most loop because it's like, what do you like? What goo has protein in it? What,
right.
You don't think of nutrition products with ones of protein. Yep. So I think that's the probably the biggest difference for most people.
Yeah. How about on the gear front? Like, are there any favorite pieces of gear that have to come with you to Barkley? Like, I mean, maybe even sure with poles. Like, are there any people that like are going like no poles out there versus poles? Like, is that a mandate?
I think, was it Greg who had no poles? No, it wasn't Greg. There was someone who had no poles. And I was like, and you just see everybody doing this identical, like, stick like a praying mantis, like movement uphill. And then there's one guy who just like, he was a little bit shorter and he was just like leaning forward and he just had a totally different movement pattern than everybody else on the hill. So yeah, if people do it, I guess different strokes for different folks. There's of course like the Leckie pole, which is like a lock-in like performance pole versus like your Black Diamond Carbon Z is kind of the classic other pole that people have, which is doesn't have the same like propulsion technology or whatever, you know, that essentially what cross-country skiers use is the Leckie type pole, which I don't think plays too much of a difference. But yeah, poles are important to me. Like the my favorite piece of equipment that I brought this year was I got like the little QB arm sleeve. So I use that for all my bearings and for my for like little mental cues for when I got to a book, it would have two or three buzzwords that I would be like, oh yeah, like two beech trees, like in between two beech trees. So that would, when I got to each book, I would know the like location cues of where I'm trying to go to. And that I kind of took from Carl. Carl had like a orienteering cheat sheet that was a great little hack and steal. And then the bag's a really important one just because you need something that you have access to and you can, like you need to be able to store your water, you need to be able to refill somewhat efficiently, and you just need to have access to it. So I used like a Palante Joey that worked pretty well. There's a lot of like Ultimate Direction out there and a variety of different bags that people use that work for them. So there's like a lot of different little tricks too. I mean, the thing that we didn't have to worry about was like cold weather or rain. So I made the mistake last year where I just like bought some last minute second layer of gloves, and I hadn't really used them in training or for that long in training, and I didn't realize that they cut circulation off to my fingers. So I was like in the middle of the night, I was like, why are my fingers physically hurt? They must be so cold from all this stuff. And then I just realized it's like, no, the
circulation,
the second layer of glove cut off all the circulation. Oh, so that was kind of like a dumb rookie mistake I made. But that doesn't really answer your gear question other than, I think there's...
The QBR sleeve was so cool.
The QBR sleeve was a lot of fun. And the other fun one was like you could kind of identify nationalities based on tight style. So yes. Like the Euro, so most of the French had like full Lycra, like, you know, long, tight, essentially. The Brits had, like, shorts. All the Brits got, like, torn up on their knees. And Ihor got, like, torn up on their knees. And then the Americans had, like, slightly less, like, fitted pant, a less fitted pant style. So you could kind of, like, you know, show off your national pride based on your pant choice for future Barkley goers.
Across those categories and any we didn't discuss, if and when you do go back, are there going to be any changes you make either for the event or in your training?
In training, I'll probably do a little more vert than I did this year, I'd imagine. I feel like that was one thing where I maybe felt a little shortchanged, where I felt a little bit weaker on the ups than I would have hoped. It's hard to tell because I think once I rolled my ankle the first time, I had a noticeable kind of decrease in performance on my climbing pace, but it definitely like got to my ego at some point where I was like, why am I so much freaking slower than literally everyone else out here on the ups? So maybe I might do that a little bit differently. But overall, I feel pretty happy with my training. I'm probably like the you know, on paper, like the least trained Barkley athlete I'd imagine in the front pack. You know, everybody, you get to the start line and you look at everybody's Strava and it's like Jared Campbell, 30K, you know, feet of vertical gain per week. And everybody's doing at least, you know, 15 or 20. Yeah. And I had like a few weeks over 10,000. And maybe I'll change my tune a little bit next year for that. But overall, I did feel pretty fit and strong going into it.
I'm looking at the clock here, 6:44. We got to get you to a Brooks team dinner in a little bit. I don't want to make you late for that, but I think the last category we should discuss is just like any general fun thoughts or memories, experiences that we haven't covered yet. I'll go first. I have two. The first is the experience of the day before the event going to the prison with Laz to go and tape up that 12th book, which depending on your direction, runners will grab pages from before they make the climb up Ratjaw. And it struck me how ceremonial that was. Like, I almost got the sense, even though it was my first time there, that Laz was almost like a a pastor or a priest-like figure in every single line of communication from the moment we parked in that prison parking lot to walking back behind the wall to tape it up. Like every single line was kind of choreographed as a part of this like 20-year experience of bringing the media back there. So that was kind of cool. It felt very ceremonial. And then also another last thing, just how interesting he is. Like all of the profiles on him, all the media attention that he has gotten for this event, A, I believe are warranted, and B, I think only scratch the surface of how interesting he is and what he has to say. Hard to pin him down ideologically. Like one moment you're talking to him, you're thinking, oh, you know, he belongs somewhere on the right. The next moment, oh, like somewhere on the left. Oh, like somewhere in the center. Like you cannot pin him down. He's such an original thinker and he's so interesting across so many spectrums. You're like, I don't know. He's just an original. He's an iconoclast. And an amazing conversationalist too. I know mm-hmm. you said that like in the Sims game, like you almost only want to get your fill of Laz for like 30 minutes at a time because you almost have to spend another 30 minutes to 60 minutes processing what he just said.
It's like Proverb. It's like you're reading Proverbs.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And so we'll link to his post-race reflections in the show notes too, and some other stuff he's written. Like Scott Hickenlooper, who's here in the background, were deeply affected by this blog post he wrote about using Barkley as a way to further build this constituency that wants to protect wild places. But just an interesting guy. And we did record a podcast with him, not a podcast, but an interview that we're going to use for an upcoming film at the event that we might publish on Apple and Spotify. So kind of stay tuned for that. But I just find him endlessly fascinating. And one of the reasons I want to keep going back to Barkley is just to continue unpacking his worldview and like you said, go back for some more Proverbs.
Well, that's probably a good one way to close this interview is our podcast is like Laz isn't the race director anymore.
Yeah.
Which we haven't talked about at all.
Yeah, Carl Laniak is coming in.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think he did a good job. I think there's a few things that happen that'll be interesting. These are the like, you know, people always talk about change and then there's like the idea of it and then there's like actually what happened. So the idea of it is like no one can be Laz, that Barkley needs fresh blood and it needs new opinions and new ideas and someone to like carry the event further. And that it's this question of like, can Carl capture some kind of magic that keeps Barkley the event that it is while also, you know, pushing it in some kind of new direction because you have a new race director who's inevitably going to have new, you know, he's not Laz in a communication style, in a personality style, and his style of communication might not work in the same kind of way Laz uses it. So it's like, that's the idea of like, oh, it's just going to be a different experience and what is different. Some of the things that will be interesting to see what happens is like, I'm pretty sure a media person like posted the map of Barkley.
Yes.
Which is one of like the cardinal sins of the event. I think there were also there were people like posting about the event outside of kind of Laz's chokehold of what they want published about the event. There are also like people who maybe dropped trash or just had like little, there were also a lot of people who spectated at the very end of the event, which Laz, you know, objectively hates spectators at Barkley and does not want anybody outside of the really core group of people who are in the race participating. And it'll be interesting to see how Carl responds to those types of events. Does he, you know, what kind of justice comes of the person who leaked the map, or just in general, what is the role of media and how it plays in positions going forward? What happens when people don't play by the old rules? Like, do the old rules still apply? Are they updated? Are they changed? Are they different? Does Barkley have this sort of really strict, intense, you know, sometimes dogmatic rule following and set of rules that seemingly doesn't make sense? Is there more leeway? And also, is the future of the event different now that we've had 8 finishers in the last 2 years and Barkley needs some kind of response, you know, and whatever the course is next year is going to be some kind of, you know, hot take to some extent of like, oh, he's not making it any harder. like they think it's the limit of edge of performance, or it's going to be, oh, this is a crazy hard event. No one's ever going to do it. Everyone's getting punished because of all these performances. It's like, how will Carl or the greater like institution of Barclay evolve after a race that has had 17 finishers after 33 years and then 8 people who finished in 2 years?
I love they used the word calibration. I think that's a really interesting way to describe the Barclay course, like how well it was calibrated to achieve the ends that it's designed to facilitate.
Yeah.
Well said. I asked Carl, I said, you know, Carl, you're the new race director. Are you going to carry on this tradition of lighting a cigarette to start the race? And he was quick to point out that Laz did not start that tradition until about 12 years ago. But then he said, no, I might do it.
Well, that's the thing, right? There's so much nomenclature around Barclay, and it's a new, you know, new blood at the top, or should be new blood at the top. Like the other funny thing was, like, Laz very clearly wanted to count Jasmine's pages after a finish, and like Carl should have been the person who counted Jasmine's pages at the end of Loop 5. So it's like, how much is Laz going to be a little bit of like a hoverer and hey, this is my baby of 35 years, and really give Carl the full show? And what does that mean for the event?
Awesome. Well, Joe, it's been, well, two things. It's been an honor to hang out with you in the sort of final month of your Barclay prep and to be there with you over the 2.5 days. I consider you a huge inspiration to my own sort of involvement in the running space. Whether or not you do it again at some point, I'm just excited to follow your career. And thanks for doing this in the midst of a really busy training camp when you should be with your teammates and recovering from Barclay and getting ready to destroy me at Cocodona.
I know, the showdown begins. Maybe that's how we truly end this, is race prediction times, Joe versus Finn, who's going to win?
Well, first of all, we're going to put a handicap on my performance. So I think we've decided that I get a 10-hour handicap.
Is that what we decided?
This
could be the first ultramarathon gambling. Maybe we like, because I mean, that's the only way to do it, right? Is like either we have to compare races, a comparable result, and determine like, one of us is objectively 10 hours faster than the other one at Cocodona.
Yeah.
So whoever wins by more or less than that is the true winner. Or you put it into the public sphere and have people give educated guesses as to who they think is going to win by how much. And money is really the only way to get people to really, you know, put their feelings on the line with any seriousness.
I wonder how we could tie this back to Barclay too. Like if we do the ladder and we allow predictions, whoever's closest, do you like give them a piece of information that helps them with the application process for Barclay? Like, what are we putting on the line?
I'll post the map of Barclay online for them and everyone else in the world to see. So no, just kidding. Just needed to get that dig out there. I still don't even know if it's totally true, but here we are spreading rumors.
You only start them.
That's true. I start them and then leave. That's what I was doing at Barclay the whole time. You say something that's like ridiculous, and then you quickly exit the door and let it just continue to fester.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And also a big thanks to our producer, Scott Hickenlooper, who is here with us at Brooks HQ, making this one-on-one live. I shouldn't say live. Sorry, I keep saying live.
Yeah,
I keep saying live. God damn it.
This
I keep
is
saying
Finn
live.
Live.
Not live, just in person.
Yeah.
There's a difference.
But thanks for having me on, Finn. It's a lot of fun. Good chatting. We've had a good time. We just did a handshake for anyone who's listening. You can do that when you're doing a live podcast with your friend.
Let's go eat some foo.
Let's get some foo.
Thanks, Scott.